This is the Rock and Roll Autopsy Podcast.
All right, I'm going to zap her again. Charge up the paddles. Come on, let's go.
Sorry, Doctor.
Hold the compressions.
Clear.
Straight line.
Good evening and welcome to Rock and Roll Autopsy. We are the Forensic Files on your radio dial. My name is Scott, and have we got a great show for you tonight? No, we don't. Damn it, the phone is ringing again. It's the request line. All right, let's pick it up. WRNRA, East of the Rockies. Hey, breather, what's going on, man? You're offended by the foul language, vulgar obscenities, and ribald innuendos frequently discussed on our podcast? Listen, trigger warning, dude. We're talking the history of rock and roll here. Bad words come with the territory. What do you mean it's not the bad words that offend you? It's the bad takes. Listen, you called the request line. Is there a song you'd like us to perform an autopsy on?
I said,
Ain't It Fun by Dead Boys? You got it. All right, buckle up, gang. The subject of our rock and roll autopsy tonight will be Ain't It Fun by nihilistic Cleveland punkers, Dead Boys. It's episode 3 of our multi-episode deep dive into Rust Belt rock and roll. So get your pierogi and Parma pink flamingos ready. We're going to find out if Cleveland killed rock and roll.
From high atop the Television 8 building and the best location in the nation. On the shores of beautiful Lake Erie.
You don't live in Cleveland.
Cleveland.
Bumble. Bumble.
Hello, Cleveland. Hello, Cleveland.
In Cleveland.
Cleveland rocks. Rocks.
Breaking news.
What is this garbage you're watching?
Hey, I want to watch the news.
This is the news.
All right, gang, we've got our intrepid rock and roll beat reporter on the line.
No, got news.
And Mark from Songs That Don't Suck, the longest running podcast in the history of podcasts about songs that don't suck. Rico, Mark, how are you tonight?
Man, fucking tastic.
I'm fucking good, man. How are you?
Not too shabby, man, but not doing well, dude. I've got this giant zit on my nose still.
You know how, hold on, let me just, instead of watching Days of Our Lives, just listen to our ongoing saga about Scott's nose. It's much, much better. So you know how, like when you're peeling a potato and you've got the potato peeler, and what do you do when you have like an eye on the potato? What do you do with that? Typically, what does the normal person do with that eye? How do they get rid of it?
You gouge it out.
Right, you gouge it out. Well, that's exactly what Scott treated his nose like a potato and tried to gouge the eye out of the top of his nose, and he fucked it all up. And so now he looks like, I don't know what he looks like now. He looks like the fucking mummy all wrapped up in gauze now. I don't know what the hell's going on.
It's a cross between what was the lead character? It was Sean Penn, but he always like had the suntan lotion on his nose.
Oh yeah, Spicoli.
Spicoli. He looks like Spicoli and the Unabomber had a baby.
Like, oh my God, that's excellent.
All right, well, you guys are not helping the. You know, I'm having some self-esteem issues here as I navigate life with this disfigurement, and you're not helping me at all. Thank you very much, friends. Rico, can we get to the news for God's sake?
Yeah, we can. So, the last time we talked about Northeast Ohio, we mentioned how Akron was really cool and things were going really sweet for them. They had, Goodyear and all that jazz, literally. And it was a really cool spot for a local for music scene in between New York and Chicago, and then the Urban Renewal Project fucked it all up, right? Well, we're getting into like the early, like the decade of the 70s, if you will. And honestly, you guys know as well as I do, like the 70s in Northeast Ohio is a fucking wasteland. Wouldn't you agree with me on that? During this time period, like it's a miracle that we had this. But before we talk about the World Series of Rock, it's funny because I looked up in several spots, lists of music festivals. Like we all know, like fucking Isle of Wight, Woodstock, Coachella, Ozark, Monterey Pop Festival. Like everybody knows the big list, right? Every list that I looked at, none of them had the World Series of Rock on it. So we're going to talk about that. So between 1974, go ahead.
Here's the interesting thing, though.
Yeah.
None of those, well, besides Woodstock, but none of the modern festivals would exist without the World Series of Rock, and it's criminal that they're not listed.
And exactly, and that's why we're going to talk about that, because between 1974 and 1980, we had here the World Series of Rock. It was like a one day, right? It was a one day concert in the summertime at what used to be Cleveland Municipal Stadium, where the Browns and the at the time Indians played. And dude, there was some. Did you guys see the list of bands that played during this?
Dude, yeah. Let's see. Zeppelin, Pink Floyd, Aerosmith, The Stones.
Twice. The Stones played more than once.
Fleetwood Mac.
Giles played more than once.
The fact that the Belkins could get all of these major stars to agree to play on a same bill, it was incredible.
Dude, that's what's the most incredible thing about this. Belkin put on this, and no, nobody really, is anybody, like, how big was Belkin at the time? It was that more of a local thing, or was that?
Yeah, that was very much a local thing. They didn't get big until the 90s.
Got it, got it. So Belkin is our local like promotion company. Like anytime a concert was put on, it was like on the radio. Like Scott, you've even like done some of that on some of our podcasts, where Belkin Productions presents, and everything was fucking Belkin around here. So really, nobody outside of here is gonna know what Belkin is. But I thought the exact same thing when I was reading stuff about the World Series of Rock. It's a miracle that they got these bands to play here, because of what I said before, because of Northeast Ohio at the time being a freaking wasteland. I mean, the flats wasn't the flats at the time. The only thing that was here that was remotely attractive to any of those bands was swingos, and we'll get to that in another episode maybe. But it's a miracle, Scott. Can you come up with any reason why they were able to land these bands in this thing?
Because the Midwest was the cradle of rock and roll, and hard rock and roll specifically, man. We had MMS back in the day, dude. I mean, all these bands were huge in this area. They were
Yep.
selling records and moving the needle in Detroit, Cleveland, etc.
Yeah, MMS, man. And we'll get to them too. MMS was ridiculously integral in the perpetuation of rock in this in the Great Lakes region, I would say, wouldn't you?
Indeed.
So and what I thought was funny is, did you guys see the part where they were talking about the clinic having nurses and doctors on site?
Well, not the Cleveland Clinic. It
Who
was
was
the
it?
public clinic or something.
Yeah, some kind of public clinic. Yeah,
Yeah.
it was some type of freak that whatever the free clinic was. But Belkin paid for doctors and nurses to be at these shows because people were going so crazy. They said the drug use was so rampant that people were like falling off of upper decks. I mean, that shit was happening everywhere though, right? I don't know why you would go out of your way to mention it here. Shit was going on like that all over at a lot of festivals, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, but those festivals weren't pulling 70 to 80,000 people, which is what the World Series of Rock were bringing in.
Yeah, I mean, and that's what's baffling about the fact that the World Series of Rock is largely faded away into oblivion, considering the fact that dude, how many seats did old Municipal Stadium used to hold?
It was around 70,000.
Okay, so around, yeah.
They would open the field, so they were, I think at max, and the numbers are hard to find. I was trying to find like numbers by show, but yeah, the high estimate's like 88,000 people for some of these shows.
Right, so the point is Cleveland Municipal Stadium used to hold a fuckload of people, and they would jam-pack these mothers for these shows, and it got crazy, and it's just baffling to me. Thank you, Belkin and MMS, for doing this. And I just don't understand how, as many people that attended these shows and the lineups that they had, man, these are such great lineups, how it this whole 6 or 7 years is just forgotten. Do you guys have any idea? Scott, do you have an idea on this?
Rico, I thought the clinic was present because Ted Nugent and Bon Scott were in town. You have gonorrhea and syphilis and God knows what. You'd need a doctor on hand.
They had freaking vending machines with penicillin in it for anybody who had a couple of quarters. Why has the industry and music fandom forgotten about this festival?
Well, for one thing, the venue doesn't exist anymore. I mean, it's funny because you say 80,000. It's like you could sell out 4 straight gigs at Blossom, you know, for 80,000, or you could sell out, you know, Cleveland Municipal Stadium once, right? But, I mean, the venue isn't there anymore. And for goodness sake, we can't get concerts to come to Cleveland anyhow, no matter who it is, much less having a giant festival here one day a year. I mean, the bigger question is, why don't any concerts come here any longer? I mean, we're getting the Rolling Stones this summer, but the big tours, Taylor Swift went to Pennsylvania. The big tours don't stop here anymore.
Well, wait till we get the dome, Scott. All that's going to change when we get the dome.
I don't know that it has to do with that. We have Rocket Mortgage Fieldhouse. I mean, you can have have concerts in there. I saw Metallica in there.
I saw U2 at Brown Stadium. So, like, I mean, we don't need the dome.
True. I was kidding, but that's true.
So, Mark, why are concerts skipping Cleveland? Like, why is Taylor Swift playing Pennsylvania and not Cleveland?
I think a lot of it has to do, and I was actually just reading an article about this. They actually, when they plan tours now, they are looking at streaming data to see where the fans are. So yep, they can actually regionalize it and hit more fans. So like the fact that she did like 2 shows or 3 shows in Detroit, like Taylor Swift, two shows, you know, she's going to draw from Canada, Michigan, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, potentially, you know, Wisconsin, depending on how far people are willing to travel, depending on where they can get tickets. But yeah, I think a lot of it is data driven now.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I was just reading an article about this because I was thinking about the Cleveland Browns Stadium, and I keep hearing people say, well, we'll get more concerts because concerts are skipping Cleveland. And I'm thinking, let's tap the brakes on that. And I was doing some reading about it, and all of these concerts are, Mark would like this, as you said, they're data driven. They've done the research. So they go where the tickets will sell and kind of what makes the most sense for them. So Northeast Ohio, whether we like it or not, it's economically depressed. You know, it's one of the poorest regions in the country. So that's a huge strike against you. So it doesn't matter how nice your facility is, they'll make the people who can afford to travel to Pennsylvania for the show or Detroit for the show will. But basing it here, there just isn't the data to suggest that it's a good decision. And tours are super expensive between insurance and gasoline and travel and hotels. They're super expensive. So they're going to be judicious in where they select to set up camp and sell tickets. I mean, it's not like the old days where they were going to every major city in the country.
And the other side of it is we have venues in this area who got greedy, Blossom in particular. So Jimmy Buffett used to come to Cleveland every summer. And there was a point where they actually started to jack up the beer and margarita prices above what Jimmy Buffett felt comfortable with for his fans. So that is one of the driving reasons why he stopped coming to Cleveland. So you've got the economic situation, like you were saying, Scott, and then you've got the greed situation where venues are trying to make as much money and much profit as they can.
Yeah, and maybe that's driven because they're just not getting the name value coming to town. So they're like, we've got somebody, we've got to take advantage of it and move as much product as possible in this window of time. So it becomes like a dog eating its own tail.
Yep, it is a very vicious circle because now, along with being data-driven, there's some that are like, you know what, we're going to get a better fan experience in another town where we're getting better prices on the stuff that people are going to buy when they're at a show. But back to the World Series of Rock. Let's talk about the good things that came out of it, right? So there was a point because the concerts had to be scheduled on off days for the Indians because they shared the stadium. There was one time where there was a huge rainstorm and the crowd screwed the field up and it was horrible the rest of the season. Through that, they actually started to change the way that fields were built. They came up with protective layers to put on top of fields that allowed events to happen in these major stadiums. Before that happened, before the World Series of Rock, that just didn't happen. So that, you know, blunder, if you will, of screwing up the field gave us a lot of these huge stadium tours.
Like those, the drainage system that they installed underneath the turf in order to accommodate that. Cause yeah, the whole turf was ruined the whole rest of the season. I think the Browns played, in a mud puddle the whole rest of the year. And I think one year they installed some decking and some, outdoor carpet in order to accommodate that as well. So yeah, I mean, it was an opportunity for them to get creative on how to bring these events here while not ruining the field for the pro team. So that's a very good point.
Yeah. They also had a huge gate crashing issue. So people would just sneak into the venues. So through that, they've improved the way they do event management and ticketing and security. So again, the World Series of Rock, you know, through their experimentation and like, you know, basically it was Art Modell trying to get more money out of the stadium. But through that, he ended up, you know, really refining the concert economy and environment on how these things were run.
Yeah, but meanwhile, Tony Bernazard couldn't field a clean ground ball because the Fog Hat fans tore up the field. I mean, come on. What am I watching all summer here? You know what I'm saying?
And Tony Bernazard. And Ernie Camacho couldn't hit the broadside of a barn.
Gas can. Yeah, Ernie Camacho.
Yeah. Oh, shit. All right. Hey, listen. What, you guys ready to take a quick break?
Yeah, I can't breathe.
Okay. We're going to take a quick break. Scott's going to go to the otolaryngologist and get his nose looked at. And when we come back, we're going to talk some Dead Boys. So stick around.
Looking for a good rock and roll book? Do you watch a ton of rock and roll documentaries like I do? Well, that's why I started the Rock Talk Studio podcast, to be the place to go for previews, reviews, and recommendations of rock and roll books, documentaries, and movies. Every first Tuesday of the month, the Rock Talk Studio gets you caught up on all the latest and points out where to go for the good stuff. Give me 20 minutes and I'll get you caught up on the world of rock and roll books, docs, and movies from every possible angle and leave you with a no-doubt decision on where to spend your time and money. Fan or just casual fan, or maybe you're on the fence and just looking for something new to check out, either way, I got you covered. Recently on the show, I've talked about books and documentaries from everyone and everything from David Bowie, Randy Rhoads, and the Allman Brothers, to the Abbey Road Studios, Cheap Trick, Stevie Ray Vaughan, Little Richard, and more. Join me, Big Rick, every Tuesday of the month as I host a Rock Talk Studio podcast, the ultimate review of rock and roll books, documentaries, and movies.
Our Mind on Music is a podcast that covers all things music. We cover all genres, and we welcome all perspectives, from musicians, producers, and content creators to music enthusiasts. We have discussions, interviews, opinions, and much, much more. We hope you'll join us every week, Our Mind on Music, on YouTube and all streaming platforms.
What's up, music nerds? Are you tired of wading through a sea of mediocre music, desperately seeking to find a glimmer of greatness? You're in luck. My name is Mark, and I am the host of the podcast, Songs That Don't Suck. Each week, I scour the depths of new music playlists to unearth hidden gems that defy the trends and deliver pure sonic bliss. No matter the genre, if it doesn't suck, it's on my radar. So find us on your favorite podcast platform and subscribe today. And as always, keep searching for and listening to Songs That Don't Suck.
We are gathered here to remember rock and roll. Rock was born the rambunctious son of country, western, and blues. In the year of our Lord, 1955. On this day, the birth of rock and roll gifted unto the world a gyrating pelvis, a throbbing beat, and a pulsating rhythm, a sound so infectious and rollicking that it would endow previously scrupulous young minds with identity, individualism, and purpose, thus setting forth a multi-generational pursuit of all that is loud, debaucherous, and unholy. But, sadly, like all earthly endeavors, rock too must perish. Oh, we mourn the loss of rock and roll, with its ridiculously old standard bearers still on tour and charging ungodly amounts of Mad Jack to witness their long past the sell-by date asses on stage, and with its chauvinism, misogyny, and whiteness no longer aligning with modern sensibilities, and with its aging, fist-shaking fan base kicking every would-be rocker off their proverbial lawn, rock has indeed passed into the celestial void. May rock rest in peace, in eternal cacophonous slumber. Amen.
Thank you for that, Scott.
You are listening to the Rock and Roll Autopsy Podcast.
The Autopsy Report.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen and children of all ages from all over the Milky Way. This is part three in our Did Cleveland Kill Rock series. As you remember, in part one, we talked Devo, and Mongoloid did not kill rock and roll, so that gave that episode a zero. In part two, we did Pretenders. That also did not kill rock and roll, so episode two got a zero. And tonight, guys, we're going to be talking about the rambunctious, the raucous, the riotous, the racy Dead Boys. Ain't It Fun? Off of their second album, We Have Come For Your Children. This was written by Cheetah Chrome and Peter Loeffner back when it was
Rocket from the Tombs.
Yes, Rocket from the Tombs, two band names ago. Before it was Dead Boys, it was Frankenstein, and before that it was Rocket from the Tombs. These guys are locals, man, Northeast Ohioans. We here refer to ourselves as Northeast Ohioans, as you remember, and all the things that you guys out there call towns and cities are just subdivisions of the greater metropolitan area known as Northeast Ohio. So they are locals. We're going to talk Dead Boys, but what I wouldn't want to know, Mark, did this song kill fucking rock and roll? I have no goddamn idea. That's why we're doing this.
That's right, man. There's proprietary science at play, and we're about to apply the shit out of this science.
Fuck yeah, Scott. How does that work?
I love it. I don't even have to do the... I don't even have to do it. It's great.
You can go take care of your nose. Me and Mark will take care of the rest of the episode.
It hurts so bad.
You know, I've listened to way too many episodes when I can like just spit the script.
It really is scripted too. We have either the most creative or the most uncreative podcast there is, because yeah, we effectively do the same one every single week. All right, gang. So it's Rock and Roll Autopsy. The artist is Dead Boys. I won't put a the in front of it. Dead Boys. The Dead album Boys. We Have Come For Your Children. The track, Ain't It Fun. Marco, we already talked about it. It's proprietary science, baby, consisting of five categories. They are gratuitous boomerism, excessive misogyny, wanton whiteness, malignant machismo, and culture vulturism. We'll just go round robin here, and I am dry. Let me take a swig. We'll just go round robin. The artist, Dead Boys, the track, Ain't It Fun, the category, gratuitous boomerism. Mark, you're up. What say you?
So in thinking about the Dead Boys, obviously they were, I think if I remember correctly, they're born in the 40s. So they are, it's, you know, squarely boomers. So I think if nothing else, I will give it a gratuitous 0.5. I don't see any reason to go a full one on them for this.
Rico.
So I have to ask myself, okay, yeah, there is the boomer aspect of it, which you were so gracious as to apply that obligatory 0.5. Good job. But I have to ask myself, like, could I take this song and drop it anywhere else besides where it was made? Could I drop this song into the 80s? Yeah, except for like maybe 6 or 7 years from beginning to mid 80s. Maybe once we get past that 5 or 6 year time period, I could drop this song into the late 80s. I could drop this song anywhere in the 90s. I could drop this song anywhere in the 2000s, and it would certainly apply. Punk rock in particular, this song embodies like the spirit of what rock and roll was born of, and I'm personally, there's no score for me on this one. For me, this is going to be a zero.
You know, it's funny, Scott, and before we jump in with your score, because I had a lot of the same thoughts about how it would drop into any generation, and it expresses feelings that I've had. But because of their age, I felt like you just have to plaster it with a 0.5. But I respect your zero.
Dude, science, man. 0.5 applies.
Yeah, Stiv Bader, 1949, yeah. Youngstown, Ohio. So firmly ensconced in boomerdom. And Cheetah Chrome. I would call these guys the main two members of the band, yeah. I think. Cheetah. Born in 1955, the year of the birth of rock and roll, also firmly ensconced in boomerdom. I will score it the obligatory 0.5, just if for no other reason than the birthdays of the two main guys. And I suspect the rest of the band falls right in there as well. Let's move on to category two, excessive misogyny. And I have the lyrics available, Mark, if you'd like to hear them.
Of course, it is literally what I live for.
Ain't it fun when you're always on the run? Ain't it fun when your friends despise what you've become? Ain't it fun when you get so high, well, you just can't come? Ain't it fun when you know that you're gonna die young? It's such fun. Yeah, fun, such fun, such fun, fun, fun. Yeah, fun. Such fun. Such fun. Fun, fun. Yeah, fun. Such fun. Such fun. Mark, do you need another verse?
I there is a particular verse that I do want you to speak, because that is where my argument is based.
I'm going to go there. Ain't it fun when you tell her she's just a cunt? Ain't it fun when she spits and leaves you all alone? Ain't it fun when you've broken up every band that you've ever begun? Ain't it fun when you know that you're going to die young? It's such fun.
Yeah. So from a misogynistic standpoint, I feel like dropping cunt and, you know, saying when she spits and leaves, leaving you alone, I feel like there's a lot of misogyny there. Like, you know, as far as things that you can, you know, call somebody, cunt is probably like right up there with Republican. sorry. Just making sure you guys are paying attention. So I'm going to give it a full one.
Rico, what say you, sir?
Yeah, I mean, those two lines in that song are pretty strong. I feel like if you look a little deeper, though, I feel like what he's saying is essentially in the spirit of those lyrics are like you call her a cunt and she's doing these things to you, but what he's really saying is I've caused this and it's really me and I need to look in the mirror, which is kind of the entire song. It's asking you to look in the mirror in the shit that you're in. A lot of it you've caused yourself. Having said that, I have to not do a full 1.0 because I appreciate the snarkiness of the lyrics. I appreciate the spirit in which it's coming from. And yeah, calling somebody a cunt is pretty strong. However, when you look at the entire song, I feel like I can only give it a 0.5.
See You Next Tuesday has a grand punk tradition. It's of course in the climax of anarchy in the UK. The track by the Sex Pistols, the Anti-Nowhere League, I think, drops a couple of them in their song So What. So I mean, this is it's a term that is embraced in the punk rock community. But why is it embraced, one might ask? Well, probably because it's one of those words that, in terms of offensiveness, especially to the fairer sex, it eclipses all other words you can throw out there. So to my better half, I have to represent this with a full 1.0 because I have to take into consideration that dropping the See You Next Tuesday is stronger than an F-bomb. It really is. And so I really would struggle to think of, I'm running down the George Carlin bit in my head. I'm trying to think of a word. I would argue almost that See You Next Tuesday is probably top of the heap at this point, that the F-bomb has become so ubiquitous. I mean, some weeks I can't even introduce Rico motherfucking Ganu without dropping an F-bomb and no one bats an eye. But if I opened up the news segment and said, "All right, gang, we've got our intrepid rock and roll beat reporter, this fucking cunt, Rico Ganu," that would get people's attention, would it not? It would.
Well, maybe you should open with that from now on, because to get more people's attention.
So for that reason alone, I'm going to score it a solid 1.0. Let's move on. The track is Ain't It Fun. The artist, Cleveland's own Dead Boys. Our special guest, Mark, from Songs That Don't Suck. Catch a new episode every Monday morning, like I do on the commute and to work.
It's the best 16 to 18 minutes of your day on Mondays. Trust me.
It's the best 16 minutes. It's the best 16 minutes you can have with your clothes on.
That's a great ad. We'll go ahead and cut that clip and we'll replace your ad after the news segment with that. All right, the categories wants and whiteness. Mark, what say you?
I think we've had this conversation before about punk rock in general being a very white medium, a white genre. There's a couple of African American or black punk bands that we have made mention of in past episodes. So I think just because of the genre alone and the honest pasty complexion of these guys, like, I mean, there's white and then there's pasty punker white, and these guys are pasty.
And then there's Steve Batter and Cheetah Chrome, which go way beyond that.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. So they're going to get a full 1.0 for wanton whiteness.
Rico, what say you?
Yeah, I mean, he said everything that I would say. And also on top of that, don't forget, they're from Rust Belt, Northeast Ohio, that went to parochial schools in the 50s. So there's nothing whiter than that. Parochial schools in the Rust Belt of Northeast Ohio in the 50s and 60s. That's some white shit, dude. So yeah, they get a full one from me on that one as well.
Yeah, I'm going to have to give it a full one as well. Listen, all points well made. These guys are, let me see if I can off the top of my head. Let's see, we've used mayonnaise. We've used saltine crackers. These guys are the Elmer's glue. Let's move on. Category 4, malignant machismo. Dead Boys. Ain't it fun? This should be interesting. Mark, what say you?
Yeah, so, you know, again, not to stereotype a genre, but when you think about punk, it is generally full of testicular fortitude. It is a very manly genre. You know, back in the CBGB days, you had, you know, bands like Blondie who were, you know, hanging with the guys. But the level of violence that these guys exhibited in their shows and that their audience then reciprocated, in the lyrics alone, there's a line about, I want to punch him in the face, talking about you got so high that you couldn't come. Like there's definitely, yeah. So I'm going to have to give it a full 1.0 as well here.
Rico.
This song for me, when I think about this song, I think about like, That Smell by Lynyrd Skynyrd. Like you would sort of a kind of cautionary tale, if you will, but it comes for me, this song comes across way different than the Lynyrd Skynyrd song, and for other than just the obvious reasons that one is a southern rock song and one is a punk song. I love the tongue-in-cheek snarkiness of this song. It kind of has a, I don't know if this is the right description, but I get kind of, what do you call that? It's kind of a passive aggressive feel to it. If that makes sense, and maybe I'm not describing it right. It kind of feels a little passive aggressive, and I love how it climaxes at the end. The ending is really aggressive, but it also, it almost for me has like a desperate sort of a feel to it. I can't penalize these guys for snarkiness, for tongue in cheek, for that passive aggressive vibe, and that desperate climax at the end that I really, really love. I'm sorry, dude. This is going to be a zero for me, to be honest with you.
It's interesting. You know, Never Mind the Bollocks by the Sex Pistols, which to me is one of the greatest rock records ever, came out in October of 1977. The album before this track is on We Have Come For Your Children. The Dead Boys' debut album, Young, Loud, and Snotty, also came out in October of 1977. So how close was Cleveland, Ohio to being the birthplace of punk rock? Now, this is granted, Ramones were already happening in New York, but I mean, I compare this to me sonically has a lot more in common with Nevermind the Bollocks than it does with the Ramones. The Ramones are all downpicked fast bar chords and kind of like the Beach Boys, you know, on speed. But this is a fucking rock band that these guys are actually like pretty good players, in my opinion, pretty good songwriters. It's a rock band. So just throwing it out there, maybe for discussion by the group. Mark, you look like you have something you want to say.
No, I was just, you mentioned the first album. Oh my gosh, it flew out of my head already.
Young, Loud, and Snotty.
Young, Loud, and Snotty. It was actually produced by a woman.
Yeah. Who went on to, did she work with, who was it she worked with after that? Oh my gosh.
Oh crap. I can't remember now.
I'm forgetting, but. Yeah, that's interesting. So, you know, but that's the first record. So are you suggesting maybe how macho can it be?
Yeah, I mean,
first record though, right?
Yeah, first record. First the record. Second one was produced by Felix or Philip, whatever, from Mountain.
The guy from Mountain, the hippie from Mountain that they didn't get along with.
Yes.
But I was just kind of wondering out loud, you know, looking at the dates, thinking about punk rock and punk rock, the true kind of punk rock era being something that was condensed really into a couple of years, just like grunge. You know, I would say grunge was really like 92, 94, you know, not like 5 years or the entirety of the 90s, right? It was really a tighter window when you had that kind of movement happening, when it was really kind of a thing, and bands were making like their most relevant records. I would argue that punk is kind of the same thing. So just kind of interesting to me that these two records from these two bands, one in England and one in Northeast Ohio, come out in the same month of the same year and sonically share a lot of DNA.
But hold on a second though. So then what is it about the Pistols where they get more of the run than Dead Boys do? Cause their albums came out at the same time and they both flamed out pretty quick. And you could probably argue that because the Pistols really only put out one album and Dead Boys put out really 2.5 albums or three, really, I guess, that technically they occupied more of that space than the Pistols did. And came out with their album at the same time. So why did the Pistols get the run and Dead Boys don't?
I think the reason the Pistols get the run is because they pissed off the monarchy.
God Save the Queen is on Nevermind the Bollocks.
Yeah, I think they created way more controversy much earlier from that album release. You didn't see the Dead Boys really pick up until, and I can't remember what year Joey Ramone ended up pulling them to New York City to play at CB's.
But it was either 77 or 78.
It was I was going to say, so I think they had a slower buildup because they didn't really start to pick up until that people started to hear about their live show with Stiv.
I would argue that it's just Nevermind the Bollocks is better than both of these records. And I think these Dead Boys records are great, but the Sex Pistols had better songs.
Yeah, I agree.
All right. Malignant Machismo. I'm off topic. It's such fun. Well, where's it at here? Okay. When you're taking care of number one, ain't it fun when you feel like you just got to get a gun? Well, you just can't seem to find your tongue, right? We're punching people. They spit right in your face. We're punching people. We're getting guns. I punch my fist right through the glass. I mean, this is macho stuff in here. Listen, it's also, to Rico's point, it's also melancholy. It's also remorseful. It's also somber. It's all of those things. It's a little druggy. It's a little nihilistic. It's all those things. But there's violence interwoven in there as well. And for that, I'm going to give it a 1 for Malignant Machismo. Mark, you had something you wanted to add.
I was just going to add that it's also very different than the rest of that album, like that I've listened to. Like, it's definitely the anomaly versus like Sonic Reducer and that kind of stuff. You know, the other song, not Sonic Reducer wasn't on that album, was it?
That was the
Sonic Reducer's first album.
Never mind. But yeah, it's different than the rest of their stuff.
It's kind of, and I guess this would knock it down a point from Malignant Machismo, but it's actually kind of a ballad in a way, you know,
a little bit.
It's got the bluesy guitar licks. It's got the arpeggiated chords. I mean, it's a little bit of like a rock ballad with an aggressive chorus, kind of got that Nirvana quiet, loud thing going on. I'm giving it a 1. Culture Vulturism. Mark, what say you?
So the interesting thing about this song is it's not actually their song when you think about it. Yeah, it's the same guys from Rocket from the Tombs, but like if I think about the bands that I've been in on the local scene, I would never lift a song from another band that I was in and play it with a new band, even if that, I mean, and granted, Roger or who's the guy that wrote it with
Cheetah Chrome. Peter Loughlin.
Thank you. Peter passed away before this album was released. So I think, I don't know, it feels really vulture-y to like pull another artist's song, even if you were in that band. I'm really conflicted about that as a local musician. Like, you know, if somebody I was playing with brought a song from the band that they were in, even though if that band wasn't playing anymore, it would just feel weird. So I think for that, I'm going to give it a 0.5. The rest of the musicality of it, I mean, they were very early on in the punk world. So I don't think they were necessarily vulturing from other bands other than the ones that they were in. But I think that's kind of a natural progression. So yeah, I think I'm going to sit at the 0.5 and be happy there.
Rico.
Yeah, I definitely see your point there, but I'm not sure. Is it vulturing if the guy who wrote it brought it with him? You got to think. Now, we've all looked up Rocket from the Tomb, and that was a really, really early on band. And the only really thing they ever, yes, they did have some original material, but all they had was a little tape recorder that they got MMS to do to play some of their stuff on the air. And they probably, I mean, I don't know how long they lasted, but they couldn't have lasted more than a few months. If less than a year, I mean, do you have info on that? Cause I didn't see anything.
Rocket from the Tombs was one of those bands that was kind of a revolving door. They had enough longevity where I had heard their name, not being a local native.
Got it.
And I've actually listened to their version of this song kind of back to back with the Dead Boys version. So I mean, I don't know, like, it just feels, I think it's different just for the number of bands that I was in. If I'm thinking, like, if I was, somebody were to pull us, even if it was like, you know, they were the songwriter in one band and the songwriter in the other, it just feel weird.
Yeah. Oh, I got you, man. Hey, I mean from my point of view, I could see if Cheetah brought the song with him, but he didn't have any part in writing it. Somebody else in the band wrote it, but he was in the band, but he didn't write it, but he took it into Dead Boys. I might have more of an issue with that, but since he was co-writer and brought it with him, I don't have as much of a problem with that.
Yeah, I mean, and that's why I gave it the 0.5, is because, yeah, I didn't give it the full one because he did have a hand, yeah, in writing it. The, yeah, fact that the other co-writer died, and I don't know if his family got any royalty out of it, any kind of payment, you know, for whatever success it had.
Yeah, who knows on that one? That's a good question.
Yeah, I don't know.
For me, it's what Scott said. I mean, partly, you know, these guys, you could make an argument that they helped invent this little version of punk rock. You know, their album came out at the same time as the Pistols. I mean, yeah, Iggy Pop and them already existed, and MC5 and all those guys, but this late 70s version of punk. So I can't give them a full one. I definitely see your point. I can't score them anything on this one, just because Cheetah Chrome actually was one of the co-writers. So I don't see any vulturism in this. So that's a zero for me.
Reading from Wikipedia, because that's what we do and no one else can do it. So they have to listen to this podcast to hear grown men reading from Wikipedia. Ain't It Fun is notable for being one of the first commercially released recordings of song lyrics containing the profanity cunt, which is said once in the song's third verse. The word's presence was not picked up on by the media at the time, with the same being the case in the release of Guns N' Roses' 1993 cover, which reached the top 10 in several countries' singles charts, despite being uncensored. So this thing was charting in 1993 as a cover from GNR, with that word just sitting there. Guys, I can remember hearing, what's the Who song? Who's Next? Or Who the Fuck Are You? Right? Where Roger Daltrey. Yeah. I can remember growing up, I'd hear that on the radio all the time, and they never edited it. And then Money by Pink Floyd, your Do Goody Good bullshit. They just let that fly when I was a kid. Now they punch that out. Have you noticed that? They punch, yeah, it out now. So, fact. I mean, 1993, man, you could hear a See You Next Tuesday on the radio and no one thought anything of it. Different world. Culture vulturism. Oh, man, I don't know, dude. It's all good points. Weird. The migration thing is a little weird from band to band. I'm going to score it a zero here. Listen, I love this song. It's my favorite Dead Boys song. I think it's a great track. I dig these two albums. I'm kind of proud that these guys are Northeast Ohioans. I think they're a pretty badass band. maybe my favorite Northeast Ohio band. We'll talk about that when we get them all under our belt. But I'm going to score it a zero here. Should we wrap this puppy up?
Let's do it.
I think it's time.
Mark, what have you got, buddy?
I've got a very solid 4.
And I've got a 3.5. Rico, what say you?
I got to grab my abacus. Hang on one second. I got a 1.5. 1.5.
For a grand total of
9.0.
We're good, man.
Yeah. Yep.
They didn't kill Rock. No. How could they possibly kill Rock? They are one of the founding pioneers of this style of music.
And as punk rocker should, they pushed up against the envelope. So
Fuck yeah. These guys are the perfect embodiment of, you know, that saying, the candle that burns twice as bright lasts half as long. That is this band for sure.
Yeah, man. I mean, what are we learning about Northeast Ohio through 3 episodes? We've got, next time we get together, I won't reveal the track yet, but let's put it this way. We spent some time with the Pretenders, Devo, and the Dead Boys, and we're going to be moving into some Heartland rock next, some Heartland rock. And so as we've kind of laid this early groundwork, and this was intentional picking these artists first, because I think we had to go back a little bit in the past. You know, we've talked about, thanks to Rico, Moondog, we've talked about jazz, we've laid kind of the punk rock pedigree of Cleveland, Ohio is established with the Pretenders and Devo and the Dead Boys. And now we're going to take a hard turn into Heartland rock. If anybody's paying attention, maybe they can guess who's coming up next. But how do you guys feel about Northeast Ohio and what's happening here musically? Are we establishing any threads? Are you seeing any kind of like any DNA kind of coalescing here?
You know, normally I would say it's Homerism bias, but it's science. Like, it's not like we're pulling punches or anything. So I really do think that, you know, as underrated as Cleveland is for so many things, it is also underrated for its contributions to rock and music in general. And I think we're proving that episode after episode.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Like, there's two things, or one other thing to kind of piggyback off of what you just said. I really, really agree with you that, you know, people often think, why the hell is the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland? And that's kind of the point of doing this, is to show people that it's here for a reason. And I couldn't have said it any better than you did, where this place is really dramatically underrated for its musical contributions. And I think, you know, and we're not, agree, there is zero Homer bias in this. Like, my 1.5 is that's how I feel. And there's no, well, there, to be honest with you, I had never listened to Dead Boys before researching this episode. So how could I possibly apply any Homer bias to this song when I had never listened to them before? So it is what it is, man. Cleveland is an underrated city. And I think that is starting to show itself.
You know, it's like Seattle has an identifiable sound. Detroit had an identifiable sound. There's a New York sound, you can kind of tell. And at least in these early episodes, you can see some kind of shared DNA here in these bands that we're exploring in this foundational kind of stage of Northeast Ohio rock and roll.
And then we're going to blow it all to shit.
Are we? We have to apply. We'll find out.
We'll apply
the science and see where. Because honestly, I think we've demonstrated more than a few times that, you know, I can say that when we've done some of these, I thought that things were going to go a certain way for certain songs, and they went completely a different way, surprisingly so, because instead of opinion, it's science, and the science works whether we like it or not. And so it might go exactly how you think it's going to go, but it might go a completely other direction. That's why these episodes are so beautiful and why they're necessary and why people have to hear this stuff.
All right, gang. Well, we got to wrap it up because my nose is killing me and I've got to go try to see if I can find my wife's tweezers. They're in this closet next to her bathroom and I don't want her to know that I'm using them to remove these giant black hairs that are literally flanking both sides of the zit. This zit started with a long black hair that I raked over with a razor that was on the lip of the bathtub. And then it got really big and red and painful. And now additional long black hairs are popping up on both sides. And here's the bad part is I can only see them in the awful fluorescent lighting of the men's room at work. And there isn't a light bulb in this house that makes them obvious to me until I'm standing in front of the mirror, washing my mitts at work after dropping a deuce and getting paid for it. And I look in the mirror and I see these giant, they look like railroad ties sticking out of my nose. And I'm like, am I going to meetings with these things sticking out of my nose? It's unbelievable.
Well, please do yourself a favor and don't try and gouge them out like an eye of a potato because you're just going to cause yourself issues. Do what you said, which is what you should have done before. You can't lance a fucking zit off of your nose because you're just going to cause yourself issues, dude. Get the tweezers and carefully pull the hairs out and it will be just fine.
And then apply witch hazel.
Witch hazel, it's godsend. Whoever invented witch hazel deserves a raise for sure.
I thought that was the stuff you use on your hemorrhoids.
It is.
See, I know hemorrhoid care. The zits I have some trouble with.
That's the H part of preparation H is the hazel, witch hazel.
Maybe I should learn to talk out my ass and sit on my face and things will be fine.
Hi-oh.
All right, Mark, thank you very much. Ladies and germs, go listen to Songs That Don't Suck.
Please.
And go listen to the Dead Boys.
Yeah.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys. Mark, good to have you back, buddy.
Always.
Let me have that special rock and roll music. Yeah.
Let me tell you, so the lyrics to real rock music is nothing more than satanic cyanide. Get it out of your house, throw it out, and burn it. It has no place in the house of the righteous.
Guys, it was like a mystique. There's no mystique anymore.
To the dawn, love it, hey, to the morning, I'm gone, I'm gone.
Follow us on Twitter at RNR Autopsy, or you can send an email to rockandrollautopsy@gmail.com, and if we run across anything good, we'll mention it in a future episode. Thanks for listening. Later.
Well, you know, that's just like your opinion, man.
Before you go, if you like heavy metal and stories, then you'll love Battle of the Bands, the narrative form metal podcast that unpacks the biggest rivalries in rock and metal history. Season 1 took in Megadeth versus Metallica, and Season 2 went across the divide to explore the beef between Judas Priest and Iron Maiden. It's like Business Wars, but metal. Find Battle of the Bands wherever you listen to your podcasts, or visit battleofthebandspod.com.